Someone entertain them.
Who, the minutes of February or March 13th?
I'll move the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson moved the March 13th minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
I forgot to ask, any discussion or comments? If not, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. The minutes are approved. Today, we are going to basically have an overview of the Transportation Omnibus Finance Bill, and we will have our Mr. Not Ferris.
Ferris,
that's right. He's going to review it for us rather than one of the reps or myself doing it. Because he's very knowledgeable, we're going to have to do it ourselves afterwards. So, Representative Holberg, you have a question?
Chair, just before they get going, could somebody clarify for me on the spreadsheet? We have two columns titled House 1 and what the difference is. I understand what base is, but not understanding why we have two columns that say House 1.
Ms. Sewers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the first House 1 column is for fiscal years 2008 and 2009, and the second one is for the second biennium.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, would it be possible before tomorrow to have a spreadsheet that shows the governor's recommendations compared to the base and the committee bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I can do that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. We'll probably have in the packet.
I know, I'm trying to...
Okay, and any other further questions? Not Mr. Burris, would you please go through the bill for us?
Mr. Chair, members, reviewing H0946DE2, it's the Delete Everything Amendment to House File 946, the Transportation Finance Omnibus Bill. Article 1 consists of the appropriations to the Departments of Transportation, Public Safety, and also to the Met Council. The appropriations match the same categories as past years, you know, including airports, transit, freight, state road construction, includes transfers, funding for the Met Council, and all the Department of Public Safety programs. Those appropriations total about $4.39 billion for the biennium. Article 2 consists of $1 billion in trunk highway bonds, and that is intended for construction on the trunk highway system. Article 3 contains a couple of different provisions relating to highway user taxes. It increases the tax on motor fuels by 10 cents. That's 5 cents in each year for 2007 and 2008, and it raises the associated tax on other motor fuels by a proportional amount. Article 3 also contains a couple of different changes to the registration taxes. It eliminates the caps. It adjusts the depreciation schedule to be faster, at a more rapid pace over the course of the years. And it also limits the registration tax on vehicles that have previously been registered so that it's not an increase in the amount of tax paid under the change in registration taxes. Finally, the Article 3 also contains an allocation of the motor vehicle sales tax revenue so that the allocation after the constitutionally mandated phase-in will be, starting in fiscal year 2012, will be 60% to highways and 40% to transit, with that 40% being split 36.5% for Greater Minnesota. I have an error. Once again, Representative Ruth, an error in my summary. It should be 36.5% to the Metropolitan Area Transit account and 3.5% to the Greater Minnesota Transit account.
Mr. Chair, do we have a summary? Is there
representative
summaries in our packets, sir?
Beg your pardon?
Is there supposed to be summaries in our packets?
There is a isn't there a summary in the packet? Representative Nelson, apparently not. I thought there was. We have some. The only The only summaries I have is the fiscal notes, Representative Nelson.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. It's fine.
Well, in the version of the summary, once you see it, will either need to be adjusted as you look at it, or will be adjusted when you see it. Apologies on that. Article 4 amends and it makes a couple of changes to the county state aid highway distribution. It establishes a concept of an apportionment sum and an excess sum. The apportionment sum is essentially the current revenues that are that go into the county state aid highway fund from the registration tax, motor fuels, and motor vehicle sales tax. The excess sum is the new revenue that is made available under this bill. And the apportionment sum, the old revenue, if you will, is allocated in the same manner that it has been. And the new revenue, the excess sum, is allocated to be 40% based on motor vehicle registration and 60% based on construction needs of the various counties. Article 5 contains a couple of provisions relating to local option taxes. One is the county wheelage tax. This is a change to raise the amount of the wheelage tax to be $20. The change also applies the tax or authorizes the tax for all counties and eliminates the requirement of an offset in property taxes. Article 5 also contains a authorization for both metropolitan counties and counties in Greater Minnesota to institute a 0.5% transportation sales and use tax, as well as a $20 excise tax on motor vehicles. The provisions relating to the metropolitan area is similar to what this body has seen discussed in the past couple of weeks. Essentially, it sets up a joint powers board, and that board, which consists of the counties in the metro area, that board then establishes grant procedures and provides grants for construction of trunk highways, capital improvements to transitways, feasibility studies, engineering, and so forth for transitways, and after 2012, operational funding for transitways. In Greater Minnesota, the tax is imposed once approved by the majority of voters who vote on a ballot question at a general election, and the tax must be for a specific transportation project, and it terminates once the project is completed. Article 6 contains a couple of transportation finance provisions. These are the largely these match what are in the governor's bill. One is the main one is to deposit revenues from motor vehicle leases, and the allocation of those revenues is in the same manner as with the motor vehicle sales tax. Finally, Article 7 contains a number of changes to license plate and driver licensing fees, raises the fees in various amounts. And that completes a quick overview of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Members, actually, that's a quick overview. We anticipate there'll be questions. If not, I presume there are questions. Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Matt, for walking through this with us. I guess I have a question on the sales tax on leased vehicles, and my question would relate then to the bonding provisions in here. I noticed that in the governor's proposal there were $1.7 billion in bonds. In this proposal there's about $1 billion in bonds. And I did know that the governor was counting on the sales tax on leased vehicles in his proposal to back up those bonds, and I'm wondering why the bonding level then is at $1 billion.
Representative Magnus, perhaps I can answer part of that, and we'll have to Mr. Burris had corrected me. But the reason we don't have the leased vehicle sales tax is because it wasn't given in our target, basically, so we don't have that money.
Okay,
and we had to adjust on the bond. The governor's, where ours went $1 billion, the governor's,
yeah,
because we didn't have the money, basically, to accommodate anything larger. Wouldn't that be correct, Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, members, the motor vehicle lease revenue is currently in the bill. The amount of $1 billion, I couldn't speak to the decision making behind that.
Yeah, actually, Mr. Burris, the lease vehicle's in the bill, but it's actually the target of the tax committee. We had to show it as an expenditure. That's why it's in the bill. We don't have the money.
So Mr. Chairman, then is my understanding correct then? With that money, if we're able to capture that money here for transportation, we could bond that. We could use that money to back up additional bonding funds. Then, if we were to decide to do that in the transportation bill.
Representative Magnus, I perhaps misled you a little bit. Technically, if we would have had that money, we probably tried to, as you were aware, put it into transit.
Okay.
But the bonding that would affect the billion or the $1.7 billion was actually the bond monies that the governor used from the constitutional amendment. That portion, that's how he set up, I think it was 37.1 or something. Isn't that correct, Mr. Burris? That bond money from the constitutional amendment, I think, for MnDOT amounted to 37 or 47 million, and that's what the governor was going to use to bond for $1.7 billion.
Mr. Chair, members, we'd have to check on that and get back to you on that question.
That's basically as I remember it, Representative Magnus.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in the documents MnDOT gave us here recently, that showed the list of projects and showed the funding on the bonding situation. We asked them specifically if Representative Earhart asked them how they were paying for the bonds, and they said they were using the additional funds from the sales tax on leased vehicles, and that's why they could fund the 1.7 in bonding. So that's where I'm trying to figure out how we can do that.
I believe, Representative Magnus, you're correct. They were going to use some for the excess, what they didn't have from the constitutional amendment. I think they were taking from the leased vehicle sales. And they were, that's why they could kick it up to $1.7 billion. That's correct. Further questions? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can you tell me how the leased vehicle money is phased in and then distributed between roads and transit?
Mr. Burris, would you comment how we put that in the bill, or not put it in, but it was had to be placed in the bill because it's an expenditure or a revenue, whatever it is, to MnDOT, so it had to be placed in the bill, but we actually don't have that. Supposedly that's the tax committee's money. Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, members, the basic phase-in of the motor vehicle lease revenue is the same as the MVEST motor vehicle sales tax revenue. And I can walk through what those numbers are if you want.
Mr. Chair, maybe I can speed this up a little bit. So does it have a straight 60-40 for transit and roads?
Yes.
And then does about half of it go in the first biennium and then phase in steps after that? Or what's the hit to the general fund, if you will, in the first and second bienniums as a percentage of the total revenue collected under that fund?
Mr. Burris, do you have that, or does Ms. Sewers have that?
Mr. Chair, members, we're looking at each other to figure out who has that.
Well,
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, are you asking about percentages or actual amounts?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm glad to see the bill follows the 60-40 split for transit and roads like the rest of the motor vehicle sales tax. But unlike current MVIS that's going to transportation, about 50%. None of the leased vehicle sales tax is currently going to transportation. So I'm wondering how you get from 0% of the leased vehicle sales tax to 100% of the leased vehicle sales tax into the transportation arena with the 60-40 split.
I believe Mr. Burris is going to answer that, Representative Holder. While he's doing that, I neglected to move the bill to bring it before us. We have basically it's a HD or HO946DE2, and I'd like to move that bill so we are discussing it. Any discussion further about moving the bill? Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. The bill has been moved, so now we can officially discuss it.
And Mr. Chair, if I might.
And Representative Holbert.
Mr. Brass is working on that. We had some discussion relative to the Joint Powers Board for the distribution of the revenues from the Metropolitan Area Sales Tax and the structure and whether it would be subject to open meeting and some of those things. I don't know if Representative Hortman has had time to look into some of those issues, but hopefully by tomorrow she might have the ability to be here and address some of those concerns and how that would operate.
She should be here, but I know she has a bill tomorrow too, but I know she's spoken to us, so that's basically her portion of the transit bill. Is that okay? She can address that tomorrow?
Yeah, I hope that this moves forward, we'll flesh that out a little bit and put a little more structure and accountability into it. And given the timeline, I mean, it's difficult for us to have amendments ready by 8 o'clock tomorrow morning to address that, but maybe Representative Hortman is working on it.
I'd just like to ask Representative Earhart, are you familiar with that enough with the transit portion of it?
Mr. Chairman, I was looking for someone in the audience to testify on this, but I don't see him. Maybe we're going to go get him.
And again, Mr. Chair, I know you have a number of bills on your agenda today. I'm not trying to slow things down. But I'm also trying to set up for tomorrow so that we can maybe get done pretty quickly in the morning.
Maybe we've got an answer, Mr. Burris. Do we have an answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, because the phase-in of the lease revenue is the same as MVES, it would be a jump so that 36.25% in fiscal year 08 would go to the general fund from lease revenue and the rest would go to transportation. So put the other way around, transportation would go from getting zero, none of the lease revenue to, in the first year, getting 63.75%.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Ruth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if someone can address this. I think this was Representative Hortman's bill as well, but we had talked about the 60-40 split. The 40 splits would be 35-5, and with the half-cent sales tax, that was the bill that we had had, and with the half-cent sales tax in the metro area, that the transit would be split 35 metro and 5 transit, or 5 rural. We have a lot of needs in the rural area. So I'm just wondering if somebody can talk to that and why this was 36.5 to 3.5.
It was actually, Representative Ruth, it was actually negotiation between the metro and rural, basically, and between legislators in that sense. We had the option of going, not option, but, you know, there was 38.2 and 36.4, and it was resolved at 36.5 or 3.5, yeah. And that's... Nobody's happy, but that was the solution. They aren't as unhappy as they would be if we had gone the other way.
Well, Mr. Chair, the reason I'm just as curious because, as I say, the bill that was presented,
if
Food Metro was able to have a half-cent sales tax, then it put the transit at 35.5. So that's why I'm just surprised that that changed. I mean, that was the presentation.
Right. We're on the assumption that everybody's on the assumption that they get the money for both transit.
Yes.
With that, with what you're speaking about, that the sales tax has to pass too, or we have some real problems. Representative Kaling? Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman, I think Schreiber has arrived, Mr. Schreiber, and I think he can answer the question that was asked.
Oh, the transit question?
Yes.
Representative Holbert, is it okay? Mr. Schreiber would address the transit question. He's familiar with the bill.
And, Mr. Chair, that's fine. As I stated earlier, I'd be happy to wait till tomorrow morning. I just kind of wanted to get ahead of that.
It's probably better if we get it.
I was looking for a little more structure to that board.
No, that'd be better if we can address it now, probably. Mr. Schreiber, can you... would you want to restate the question you had, Representative Holbert?
Well, Mr. Chair, I thought when Representative Portman presented this bill, we had some discussion around some of the issues about Joint Powers Board, data practices, open meeting, and that while the bill as presented was a nice initial idea, if in fact this bill was going to become law, that there may be a need for additional provisions in that portion of the bill. And so I'm just curious, will we see an amendment tomorrow that will provide that structure? Is anybody working on it? Do I need to hustle around and get an amendment ready, or where we're at with that?
If I may, before we welcome Mr. Schreiber, we did discuss that when our staff and myself and the vice chair, and looking at it, we thought, and maybe I'm incorrect, but we assumed we didn't want to put too much in the bill as far as the joint powers group, and I believe I'm correct in addressing that, and we thought we'd leave it up to their discretion when the joint powers groups would meet, and I believe, Mr. Schreiber, could you address that, please? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and for the record, Bill Schreiber representing the Metro Transit Ways Development Board. Representative Holberg, you have a good question, and as I understand the statutes, and we'll make copies for you, but the joint powers, there's a whole section of state law that regards joint powers board, which allows cities and counties and so on to do things. The same data practices, open meeting laws, all of that is applicable to joint powers board in the same fashion that it would be for the individual bodies acting on their own. So I don't think any additional correction is needed in that regard. There is a specific authorities in joint powers board that if it would go beyond what a county would have on its own or a city would have on its own, that is enumerated. But quite frankly, to my knowledge, other than the regional rail authorities joint powers legislation, which is confined to rail corridor activities, those activities go beyond what a county board would or a city council would normally be able to do in making grants and all of that type of thing.
Okay, and I appreciate that answer, and it's been brought to my attention that we reference a section of law, which I'll review before tomorrow morning just to make sure that there's enough structure there to support my concerns.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. I think that's the section that Mr. Schreiber is explaining. You have further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, Representative Kaling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification question for, I think, Mr. Burris, but Representative Morgan, who's about 90% of the intelligence between the two of us here, couldn't find, neither could I, the least portion of the bill, so if you could just direct us to that.
And Mr. Burris will address that. We actually don't have that money, but it's in the bill. I guess you just went through that, Representative Kaling.
Yeah, we're just trying to find the actual language.
Mr. Burris,
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Identify that.
Members, the actual language is on page 35. It's page 35 starts on line 3.
The method is a bit technical, which is probably why it's a little hard to find.
Mr. Bruce, do you say line 3?
Yeah, page 35, line, starting on line 3. It's section 2 of
with
article.
With divided revenues.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You got it.
Just, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so that we're all operating on, or that the two of us all are operating on the same, that section 297.815 is the least section, is that correct?
Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, members, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Magnus?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a bit of a question in my mind about general funds in the total amount of general funds here. And I note, for example, on page 9, the Met Council is getting almost $79 million a year. 73 goes to bus transit and about $5.3 million to rail. But my question, Mr. Chairman, is, and I know Ways and Means hasn't given us a target yet, we need to work through that, but there's no other significant amounts really of general fund money into the bill, is there, that I could see?
Representative Magnus, there's some public safety monies, I believe, in this bill. Mr. Burris or Ms. Sewers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, the majority of the general funds are in the Met Council, but there is some in public safety as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Just giving a little time to look at. I know we won't be voting on it, as you're aware, till tomorrow, but I thought if you have some questions, yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Ruth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other question I had with Article 6, Section 1, it's on page 34, line 28 and 29, and I was just curious why the change, but this is referring to the highway revolving loan account, and that it said they may transfer the money out of there to the trunk highway fund, but I'm just curious, have there been excess dollars, or why that was brought forth?
Representative Rules, that's kind of a technical one, because that it authorizes them to move it back and forth. Sometimes they're putting it in, sometimes they're taking it out, as far as a revolving fund, and that's strictly trunk highway funds. It's kind of an internal thing, just basically it doesn't involve any money other than the money we've authorized for them, and I believe that's correct, Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ruth, yes, the MnDOT had some testimony on this, that they have this loan fund, and it includes trunk highway dollars, so those dollars can only go towards the trunk highway system, and their proposal is to shift that to just be in the trunk highway fund, so they're not loaning to themselves.
Thank you. Yeah, I remember that. Thank you.
Representative Magnus, I mean, we can give as much time as we want, and I just wondering what...
I think, Mr. Chairman, let's go ahead and move on the agenda. If we want to, we can come back later on if we want to, okay. After the agenda. I don't think we have any other questions that we could...
Mr. Burris or Ms. Sewers, do you have any further comment?
No.
If not, unless the members have any questions, We can be sure you put the bill in your packets for tomorrow morning. And actually, you have a summary statement. So tomorrow, we'll be able to move on the bill. Actually, I suppose if you want, you certainly can take the bill with you, but be sure you bring it back in the morning that we'd have it. So you have it, although we will have additional copies, I'm sure. We'll just wait a moment. Perhaps Representative Holbrook may have a question. Again, for the members, we're starting tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, and I should say that we will have to recess at 9:30. There's something that takes precedence, Ways and Means, in the caucus, I believe, and some of your members and our members are involved. So, if you have amendments, and I understand there might be an amendment or two, if we could have them, if you have them, if not, wait. Be sure you have amendments in the morning so we can act on them relatively quickly. Yeah. Representative Holbrook, do you have any further questions, Jane?
Mr. Chair, I don't, but I am going to take a look at that joint powers statute, and just from first review, I think we might need to do a little additional work on accountability.
Well, thank you. Unless there are any questions from the members, we can lay the bill aside till tomorrow. So we'll do that, and we can proceed with our agenda. Thank you. So our first bill up, we have... we have House File 311, Representative Hornstein.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 311 for passage, and I think re-referral to Representative Mullery's committee. Public safety.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Hornstein moves to pass House File 311 to the full Finance Committee, and recommended referral to the Public Safety and Civil Justice. That's what your thing is.
Thank you. That is the proper motion, Mr. Chair.
Testimony filed.
Quiet in the room. It's hard to hear.
You can't hear, you see?
It's difficult. There's a lot of noise back there.
Could we have it quiet in the audience, please? We're having a little difficulty hearing. Maybe they can't hear. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. That's better, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 311 is commonly known as the hang-up and drive bill. This is a bill that was brought to my attention by Mr. Donnie Harder, who's sitting to my right, and he'll explain the bill and discuss its origins and its goals, which are quite compelling. But this is simply a doubling of fines for moving violations while on a cell phone. And it simply is, I think, in many ways a message to the public about the dangers of driving while distracted. We have had a proliferation of cell phones, and now cell phones include all kinds of other gadgetry. Text messages, television, things of that nature are now part of the cell phone revolution. And as we've seen more cell phones, we've just seen more drivers using them, and I think there's very, very firm evidence, widespread evidence, that this creates a distraction. And So this is a public safety issue at its core, and I want to be very clear that this doesn't ban cell phones. There's other legislation that's been introduced that does that. This doesn't ban the use of cell phones. It just simply says if you're going to use it, you're risking not only an increased fine, but other people's safety. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll just call on Mr. Harder, who is a freshman at Southwest High School, which is in my district, and he brought this issue to my attention, and had some personal experience with the problems that this bill is trying to address, and I appreciate his involvement in the process, and he's been a great partner to work with in terms of bringing this issue forward. So there aren't any additional questions of me. I'd just as soon have Mr. Harder discuss the bill, and then we can have a broader discussion, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Harder.
Thank you. First, I wish to thank the chair and the committee members for...
Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
I'm Donnie Harder. First, I wish to thank the chair and the committee members for hearing my bill today. I'm a ninth grader at Southwest High School, and I'm in the International Baccalaureate Program at my school. I presented this bill last year, and since then, I've noticed a lot more things going on with cell phone use. And I noticed there are many distractions that occur in cars, but cell phone use is the most dangerous because it requires a person to think, answer, and respond, which is much more complicated than changing a radio station or drinking a cup of coffee or reading a magazine or shaving. In fact, according to a State Farm Insurance survey done in 2005, more than 40% of the people they surveyed said that they had close calls or near misses with a driver who was using a cell phone. And I'm sure that you yourselves have had close calls with somebody using a cell phone. Cell phone use is the leading distraction in cars and can also be tracked to the time of the violation if necessary for proof. People can cause violations with other distractions, but you cannot prove, actually have tangible evidence that someone was changing the radio station or drinking a cup of coffee at the time of the violation. A study by California Highway Patrol, which led to the state's recent legislation, found that cell phones led more accidents in the first half of 2001 than distractions from kids, pets, smoking, eating, personal hygiene, etc. Researchers at the University of Utah published a study that claims drivers on cell phones are prone to more crashes than drunk drivers. 40 test subjects drove a simulated highway while undistracted, drunk, and then talking on a cell phone. The cell phone using drivers crashed 3 times, while the drunk drivers surprisingly did okay. Researchers suggest that cell phones make drivers more sluggish in perception and reaction. The state has penalties for drunk driving. If you truly want to improve safety on the road, you would also impose strict penalties for cell phone use as well, because it is bad and almost worse. It is worse than drunk driving. The Be Safe and Drive bill has support from the Brain Injury Association of Minnesota, the Minnesotans for Safe Driving, Truckers Association, and the Minnesota Ambulance Association. And it would be nice if the cell phone companies would also support this bill and promote safe driving, like the alcohol industry does with their Don't Drink and Drive campaign. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Harder. Are there questions from members? Representative Slocum.
I have 2 questions. First question, what a terrific job you just did. Where did you go to middle school?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I went to Lake Harriet Community School.
I almost bet on that. Yes. Okay, my other question is, what about the earbud? You know, the phone that's the earbud. It frees up the hands. Is that as dangerous?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the hands-free versus mobile phones, there is no difference. The fact is that they're distracted either way. It doesn't matter if they have no hand, they have no right hand or not. It's just the fact that they're distracted at all. It imposes a risk on other drivers and as well as themselves.
Any further questions? I represent Severson.
Mr. Harder, good to have you here before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm just wondering, and my question was similar to that with the earbud, particularly experience, probably myself included, is, you know, with the hand phone, having one hand occupied and then trying to maneuver it with the earbud, you've probably got voice activated. How would that be different than having someone sitting in the car next to you?
Mr. Chair, Representative, with a person right next to you, they are actually there with you, and they can see what situation that you're in. If they see that you need to slow down, if you're in rush hour, they stop, and they can help you direct. And that's what my mom does with me in the car. Not that I talk on cell phones or anything, but having a person right next to you, it's a lot easier for. They can help you out instead of a person on a cell phone. They aren't in the same situation as you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Harder. And I guess I don't have any other questions.
No more questions, you said?
No, thank you.
Thank you. He does a good job in answering, didn't he? Representative McKaylin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Harder, I think that Representative Hornstein should be watching his back on the road. He may have a primary challenge here.
Chair, he actually lives in Representative Thiessen's district.
Representative Thiessen, I think Representative Thiessen just left the room. So, very impressive, Mr. Harder, and it's a pleasure to have you here. Representative Hornstein described this bill as the hang-up and drive bill, and I have just a lot of hesitation about this approach to the hang up and drive, but I'm curious about how you feel, Mr. Harder, about the other approach that Representative Hornstein referenced, which was just moving to either only hands free and banning all cell phones that aren't hands free, or even not allowing any cell phones. Isn't that the New York model? How do you feel about going that route, Mr. Harder? Thank you,
Mr. Chair, Representative. This cell phone bill does not ban cell phones at all. All it does is make sure that people think twice before they pick up the cell phone and drive. That's why we call this the Be Safe and Drive bill.
I misspoke. It's really the Be Safe and Drive. I think Representative Yarrow says the Hang Up and Drive.
You get that, Representative Kill?
Yeah, I do. Thank you. And it actually helps me a lot to make that differentiation. And I think we sometimes make mistakes as policymakers, and I guess I'm sharing this as a new representative, sharing this with perhaps a future community leader and elected official about me taking my own personal experience and extrapolating that, and I'm actually about to share that experience rather than just make sure I'm not projecting this onto you and accusing you of doing the same. I was the first on the scene in my first year, my second year of teaching, and I was the first on the scene to a near-fatal accident where the driver was about a year or two older than you and had a pulse of about 8 and had no life in her face and was clearly had been taken on a T with a SUV as the driver, and it was one of the worst moments of my life. And there was Dairy Queen just spread all across the car. And she and her friend had been just stopped at the Dairy Queen down the road and been distracted on that level. And I think that I'm very concerned. I lost older siblings of students to fatalities, and I'm very concerned about, especially young drivers, but all of us. And you make a very compelling point. I think that we don't quite take the approach that's in this bill. I don't think is the most effective way to get at the point. But I would love to work with you, Mr. Harder, to continue to try to end the distractions or reduce the distractions, especially from cell phones and eating as well. But really, it's a pleasure to have you here, and you make a very compelling point.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harder. I'm going to get back on what Representative Severson was talking about. So if you have the earbud in your ear,
And that's, that would be evidence that you were talking on the phone, even if you're not. Just having the earbud in your ear, if you got pulled over for a ticket, they would double the ticket, because the assumption then would be that you were talking on the cell phone just because you have the earbud in your ear. I guess that's a question I have. Would that be how you read this bill, or Mr. Harger? And Mr. Chair, the reason I ask that, because I know some people that I personally don't have an earbud, but I know some people that do, including Representative Lesh, who seems to walk around all the time with it in his ear, whether he's talking on it or not. And I guess would the evidence of having it in your ear be proof that you were talking on the cell phone?
Well, if it's, you can still track the cell phone records to the bill, at time of the accident. So if the cell phone is an activity, I don't know.
Could you speak in the mic, Mr. Harder?
Sorry. That you could track the call to the time of the accident using cell phone records and use that as proof to make sure that they were in use, the cell phone was in use at the time of the accident or violation.
But Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the officer on the scene who's writing you the ticket for, say, speeding or making a illegal turn or whatever they're moving violation they're writing for, would not at that time know that you would not be able to track that at that time. You would have to go to your records and go back and prove that, and so therefore you'd have to come to court and fight it. So that presumption that would be because you had the earbud in that you were talking on the phone. I mean, granted that you could prove it later on by taking your records in, but still, you would have a double ticket being written up on you for driving while on the cell phone just because you had that earbud in your ear.
Mr. Chair, Reverend Smith, like most bills, this bill won't catch everybody, and you can still, there are still little tweaks to this bill that still need to be changed, and some, there was a change of, I believe that there was a change to some language in the bill. I'm not totally sure. But if the phone is an activity, that it would double the fine.
Representative Hornstein, you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Mr. Harder is referring to an amendment that was added in the Senate hearing and that addresses this. So, you know, we certainly can. I wasn't aware of that amendment, and certainly we can, address that in a future committee.
You understand the question, Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Well enough. Representative Nelson?
Yeah.
For the comment?
It's just another comment, and it's going on with what Representative Seawasser was talking about, two people talking in the car. I don't know if we've seen anyone seen that car commercial where the two guys are talking in the car and chatting back and forth, and they T-bone somebody backing out of the driveway. And from some of the stuff I've read, that's just as much of a distraction sometimes talking in the car, which is why we've had bills to limit the number of passengers teenagers can have or probationary drivers can have in the car, because of the distraction factor, especially for younger drivers. Although I have, we also read statistics that show that, like you said, that whether you're driving and talking on a hands-free cell phone or talking one with you that you've got in your hand, that the level of distraction and inattentiveness is just as high either way. So I do agree with when you say that. And I'll have to admit that I do at sometimes talk on myself while I'm driving, so I'm as guilty as anybody else. So, thanks for your answers. I don't mean to badger you. I just had the questions that I had.
Thank you. Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Harder, I guess one of the questions I have is, you can probably see those blue books that we have in back there. Those are all filled with statutes. We do this for a living. We make law, and we make a lot of it. And I'm just wondering if there's a consideration that has been put in here in terms of the law enforcement officer considering just reckless driving, which we currently have on the books, and just using the current statutes and maybe informing our law enforcement that, you know, maybe we just need to be a little more stricter and include on a cell phone as reckless driving under that certification. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that one.
Mr. Harger, for you. You're asking Mr. Harder, representative?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Harder?
I'm sorry, I didn't really understand the question.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Harder, you know, currently we have a lot of statutes. We have a lot of laws on the books, and one of those is reckless driving. I mean, it's kind of how a policeman pulls you over because you're swerving over the line or you're doing something erratic. And I think this probably contributes to that, just like alcohol or some of those other things would. And I guess I'm kind of wondering why we'd want to make another law that could, that just, in,
okay. I'll take a crack at that. Mr. Chairman, Representative Severson, I think that you raise a valid point, but part of what, you know, Mr. Harder mentioned earlier, you know, we're not going to catch everyone, and, you know, we're not going to, you know, have a dragnet for cell phone, you know, use here. I mean, that's not what this bill is intended for, but I think a lot of the use and value of this is to say this is a unique and growing problem, and it's a situation, and by us passing a law and including it in those blue books and having this kind of discussion and public dialogue, that gets out into the public, and you know, we want to prevent this. This is more of a preventative idea, so that we send a message that it's unsafe, and you know, if you're caught, you're going to have to pay a little more money. So what percentage are we actually going to get? Unclear. But by doing this, Representative Severson, it's not simply just in the category of reckless driving. It sends a strong public safety message out there into the community. And I think that's one of the values of the bill and why I support it.
Representative Severson, I think this will be interesting when it gets in that public safety with all the attorneys.
Yeah.
I don't think we have any attorneys in our group, do we?
No.
Representative Morrow had a question. Do you have a follow-up?
No,
You teed him up.
Well, Representative, I will keep my attorney status quiet for a moment. Your bill has me thinking. I was thinking the other night when I answered a call from my younger daughter. I'm 100 miles away from her, and she was on the phone, and she was crying because Mom was sick. And she didn't know what to do. I'm afraid that this would criminalize my picking up of that phone call for violation occurred at the same time. So I agree with the intent. It does have me thinking, but I am worried about the situation that other parents might find themselves in. Do I pick up a call from home? So I'm concerned about that implication.
Do you want to comment, Representative Hornsky?
Mr. Chair and Representative Warner, that's a very good question. And I'm recalling you know, when we did announce this bill publicly, and a similar concern was raised, and Senator Dibble, the co-author, answered and said, you know, if you feel confident in your driving skills and you're in a safe situation, we're not saying, you know, that we're saying this is a flashing yellow light towards people that are using cell phones. And you are the best judge of your situation and your driving ability. And, you know, of course, when a cell phone rings, you can pull off to the side of the road. Sometimes if you're on the interstate, it's a little more difficult. But, you know, this does allow the individual to use their discretion. It is not a ban. And I think Senator Dibble, I thought, answered that question very well when he said, you have to make that decision. If you're confident of your skills, of the situation, you know, maybe the weather's good, there's not a lot of other cars around. I mean, this is a very situational type of judgment call one has to make. Then answer the phone. And you're the best judge of that. But we're simply, again, trying to send a message that there's a lot of situations where people are driving. You know, the other day, I'm driving down 35W on my way home. Someone's changing lanes in heavy traffic in a big SUV on the cell phone, and I was like, ooh. So, you know, those are the types of situations one really should show some discretion.
Representative Hausman.
I didn't know if the testimony in our packets had been referred to.
Not at this point. I was going to point that out.
It sort of gets at this conversation we're having where, you know, do we have current laws that should be applied with reckless driving? And this one seems to suggest that at least in this instance, law enforcement, without any other tools, didn't seem to be interested, and there was no ticketing relative to the cause of to be hitting this bike rider. So it appears that current law is perhaps not clear enough on this issue.
Representative Hausman was referring to a letter that I was going to call your attention to in your packet. It's actually a an email, copy of an email. Did you want to comment? That was not a question. Perhaps
no,
you
just, it appears that she actually even went to the police department, and there was no reference even to the fact that cell phone had been involved in the accident.
I think Representative Hornstein, a lot of these questions are going to be addressed, I would presume, in the Public Safety Committee, and perhaps we've drawn your attention to it again, but you do have other testifiers, too, so are none
of
the testifiers.
Mr. Harder is the only one that I personally, you know, there might be
we other... We do have another gentleman for testifying.
Yeah. If any, I'll take all comers in terms of...
Unless there are further questions...
Mr. Harder is the only one that I formally recruited.
Further questions of Mr. Harder? Not. Thank you very much, Mr. Harder, again for appearing. Fine job. Mr. Otto in the audience?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome to committee, Mr. Otto.
Chair and committee, my name is Elmer Otto. I'm from Shakopee. And I have a 3-minute video that shows that when a driver gets on the phone, he has tunnel vision. We always hear about distracted driver. This is not the same as if you're turning on your radio or some other thing like that. This is a completely different kind of distraction. The video brings it out, and there's no use for me to ramble on about it. It's a 3-minute video. I'd like to...
Can you handlight the page or not? Is that...
If somebody could do it for me?
Is this a short video, Mr. Otto?
3 minutes.
Mr. Representative Hornstein, you have other testifiers. Is this it? I'll check with the audience.
I just saw today that Mr. Otto was coming, and I know that we've been in communication, and really only Mr. Harder was the only one that I was aware of.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Hornstein, do you have
Well, Mr. Chair, while she's getting that hooked up, I just want to commend Mr. Otto for years and years of commitment to safety and safe driving. He has been consistent in his communication with us, and I think, Mr. Otto, we owe you a huge debt of gratitude for your tenacity. You do not give up, and you continue to bring these very important issues to us, and we thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
Doesn't work.
We may be experiencing some technical difficulties, Mr. Chair. Why don't we let the page maybe work on it for another minute or two? But if we can't have the video, I think we've made a pretty good case already. And maybe, Mr. Otto, do you have maybe some oral testimony in addition to the video that you'd like to give? If it's not going to work, we'll just try one last time here.
Hello. But once she picks up the phone, a different story. Look at the black dot net.
That was always fun as a kid to watch him go back. Remember that?
Hey, look, they're going backwards.
They didn't have these things,
and
I was
thinking. Traffic. It's bad enough when road conditions are good. But that's cell phone to the man.
I got behind people with, who are using cell phones all the time, and I get the impression they don't have a clue what's going on around them.
He may be right. Todd McLeish took part in a recent groundbreaking study on what physically happens when we talk on the phone while driving. Unlike previous research that simply shows cell phones are distracting, this is the first scientific proof that our brains actually lock up, that we go into a tunnel vision of sorts.
Yes, I'm talking xenophobia across the board, and this is one of them. Happy eye movements are reduced.
Dr. Manveer Sodhi developed the study at the University of Rhode Island. Here's how it worked. Test subjects drove a predetermined route wearing this head-mounted device that videotapes eye movements. Then they were given tasks to perform.
Tune to station 1540 AM.
Take a look at the little black dot. When driving normally, even changing a radio station, this driver's eyes bounce all over the place. Up, down, side to side, showing a high level of alertness to her surroundings.
Hello?
But once she picks up the phone, a different story. Look at the black dot now.
Range of eye movements drops significantly, which means your eyes aren't moving over the scene.
It happened to all the drivers tested, and the results were the same whether they were holding the phone or using a hands-free system.
It doesn't matter where your hands are, it matters where your head is.
Judy Stone heads up the Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety. She says she's not the least bit surprised by these findings.
It just makes common sense that when somebody is distracted by talking on a cell phone, they're going to be looking almost at a fixed object in front of them.
Regina Pedroso was the guinea pig here. She and others in the study say it's frightening that their eyes stop moving.
I'm trying to, you know, drive really well, and it takes up quite a bit of time.
I was paying attention to the thinking process and less to where I was supposed to be driving.
And the Pentagon has a word for it. They call it cockpit overload. And it just means that, you know, it's a drain on your brain.
Cell phone distraction is a major concern. A recent study by the Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety finds 76% of Americans now favor legislation restricting the use of cell phones while driving.
We were a little surprised at the strength of the feeling on the part of the American public.
But with all the concern, she says there is an easy way to avoid the tunnel vision.
If you feel you have to use your cell phone while you're driving, please pull off the road.
Randy Kay, WCCO 4 News.
I want to thank Mr. Otto for that very good audio-visual testimony.
And thank you, Megan, for getting it organized.
Yeah.
Mr. Otto, do you have further comment?
I think the video says it all. It's not... You know, when you talk about distraction, distracted driver, this is not the same.
Unless there are questions for Mr. Otto, appreciate the video and appreciate your comment.
Thank you.
Did you have a question? Oh, Representative Beard?
Oh, not a question. Just this is my good constituent, Mr. Otto. I just want to say, Elmer, thanks for coming down today. And members, I assure you, I hear regularly and often from Mr. Otto about several topics like this. And Photocop is up next, Elmer, if you want to just hang around for a few minutes. I don't know if you brought a video about that, but it's coming.
I have quite a few videos on that, too.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Otto. I appreciate the emails. I think we all do. We get a lot of emails from Mr. Otto. Representative Hornstein, I think we've had enough testimony for the proponents. I don't know if there's an opponent that wanted to testify in the audience. Apparently there is. Are there anyone in the audience who wants to testify? If not, Representative Hornstein renews his motion that House File 10, wait a minute, not 10. House File 311. Be recommended to pass and referred to the full finance committee with a recommendation to be referred to the public safety and civil justice committee. Any comments? Not all in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Contrary, no?
No.
The motion prevails. You're on your way.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair members.
The next bill up is Representative Thiessen. For the members of the committee, before we start losing members, we have the room not too much longer. Normally our committee time ends. But we do meet tomorrow morning at 8, and if you have amendments, be sure you bring them so we can expedite tomorrow morning. And again, if you take your copy, bring it back in the morning. 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. Representative Thiessen, we appreciate if you can kind of avoid repetition. I think it's going to be a long session. Well,
I know the feeling, Mr. Chair. I need someone to move
probably,
it.
I'll move House File 1058, Representative Thiessen, to be before us. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, and I think it may be worthwhile to add that I have two author's amendments, the A1 and the A2, that I'd like to put on. Are those with you? The A1 amendment.
The chair will move House for our A1 amendment H1058A1.
Yes, thank you, Mr.
All
Chair.
In favor, say aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. The amendment's removed.
And the A2 amendment?
I actually am not calling for an explanation because they're relatively simple. You can explain them after. Yeah.
Yeah.
House for H1058A2, the amendment before us. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary. The amendment is adopted. And Representative Thiessen.
And just briefly on the amendments, members, just so you kind of catch up to speed on it. One, the first amendment, the main change is that these violations, if you are ticketed for running a red light with the photo cop, it won't go on your driving record. It won't show up in your driving record, so it adds that provision. And the second amendment just says that a contract, you know, when you contract with the companies that provide these services, they won't be, their fees won't be based on the number of tickets that are issued. Thank you for hearing this, Mr. Chair and members. This is the photocopy legislation, and it's really a fairly simple idea. It's basically aimed at increasing traffic safety. And the thing about it is we know it works at doing that because it happened in Minneapolis. It happened in many other places across the country as well, but in Minneapolis for several months, and they had a 31% decrease in crashes and a 42% decrease in what are called T-bone crashes, which are kind of the very dangerous kind of crashes where you're running into the side of a car. So, you know, it saves lives, it avoids injuries. This law will avoid property damages. I think it'll ultimately save on insurance rates. And so with that, following the chair's guidance, I'm going to turn it over to the witnesses and let them explain the legislation a bit more. This is Councilmember Paul Ostro from the City of Minneapolis.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Thiessen. Joining me today before your committee is our Assistant Police Chief, Sharon Levinsky. Also, we have with us today Greg Reinhardt, who is the Lieutenant in charge of our traffic unit. Also, Mary Ellen Hain, who is the City Attorney, who has been handling the legal matters involved in the Stop on Red program, which is what we actually prefer calling it, the Stop on Red program. I come to you wearing perhaps more than just one hat. I'm not only currently a member of the Minneapolis City Council, I also spent 12 years of my professional life as a city attorney prosecuting traffic violations and saw firsthand as an attorney representing actually the suburbs of Blaine and Little Canada the impact that running red lights would have. I also am before you today as the chair of the Hennepin County Criminal Justice Coordinating Committee that has this is on its legislative agenda. I just today attended a meeting of the Minnesota League of Cities, and I know the author of the bill has a letter for you showing the support of the State League for this initiative. So there's very broad support throughout the state of Minnesota for this initiative because, as Representative Thiessen has told you, this does prevent accidents. This does, in fact, save lives. It's a proven, effective tool for law enforcement. And with that, what I would like to do at this point is I know there are some videos that we have. Three show crashes from Minneapolis, and then there's another video which shows an overview of the program.
Oh,
Ethan isn't having a place right now.
So here? Okay.
Well, we'll proceed with testimony while we're working on this. How about that?
If you would, I'd appreciate that.
While the audiovisual is being corrected, we'll continue to proceed here. And the Stop on Red program is a traffic safety program, and what it uses is sensor and camera technologies to decrease the number of red light runners, and it's been used specifically at 12 intersections in the city of Minneapolis. It was launched in the summer of 2005, and in close to 8 months of operation, approximately 25,000 violations were issued. And as Representative Thiessen mentioned, 31% decrease in crashes and a 42% reduction in the right angle accidents, which are the T-bone accidents, which are the ones that are caused most frequently by these violations. With that, what I'd like to do would be to turn things over to Assistant Chief Levinsky for a few comments.
Welcome to the committee.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representatives. I'm Sharon Levinsky, Assistant Chief with the Minneapolis Police Department. What this technology is for us has really meant an increase in public safety on the streets of Minneapolis. How the Stop on Red program works in terms of the technology there, we selected 12 intersections through being able to track the most serious accidents at very busy intersections. The technology has sensors actually in the roadway to indicate when a vehicle is going through the intersection on the red light. That starts up cameras which actually take 3 still photos and actually almost about 12 seconds of video, which has a documentation of that violation. In turn, that is also made available to the registered owner of the car when a traffic citation is mailed to them. They can actually get one of those still photos, and they can actually were able to access the video online to actually see their vehicle going through that intersection. This does not start up the system if somebody is already, for example, in the middle of the intersection and ready to turn in, on a red light if they've entered the intersection legally or with a legal right turn out of that intersection. At all of the intersections, we have been very upfront with where the technology is, where Stop on Red is. Each of the intersections is posted with signs, and not only that, we worked with the local media that was posted in the Star Tribune, as well as all of those intersections were posted online so that people knew exactly where that technology was. We were very upfront. And for us in the police department, the bottom line is we were able to reduce, especially the right angle accidents, which are really often serious accidents and fatal accidents. So it's made a real difference for us in terms of overall safety.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if we're ready yet with the technology, but what, with your indulgence, this bill did go through, as I think you're probably aware, a rather extensive discussion on the Senate side, and as a result of that discussion, we certainly are aware of some concerns that have been raised that you may hear about today. We would appreciate the opportunity to briefly speak to some of the concerns that have been raised. I can do that either before and probably maybe after the video. Okay. Okay.
And there's my son.
Oh, I don't know. All right. All right. Why don't we go to the rest of the testimony?
Okay. And there may be times, I'm sure, Mr. Chair and Representatives, you may have some questions for us, but there may be some times where I'd like to have some of the others address some of these issues. But I'll try to go through them as quickly as I can. First of all, one of the issues that I think you've heard about is the issue of mission creep, that this will somehow be the camel's nose in the tent, and you'll see this kind of technology used for speeding or any number of other traffic violations, and that is just simply not the case for several reasons. Number one, the bill that you have before you is specifically limited to authorization for the Stop on Red program. It would need to be separate legislation at some point if it would be ever used for another type of violation. Number two, the same infrastructure cannot be used for using this for speed or some other kind of violation. And third, I will tell you as perhaps the biggest proponent on our council for this, I don't support this for speeding, and I don't know of any support on our council for using this for other types of violations. Another thing that we have heard quite a bit about here that's been raised are the issues of due process, and I would like at this point Mary Ellen Haynes to come forward, who is our city attorney, and speak to the issues of due process that have been raised relating to the issuance of these citations against the owners of the vehicle.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm Mary Ellen Haynes. I'm an assistant Minneapolis city attorney. I've been involved in the Stop on the Red program from the get-go. One of the things, there are some existing state laws already that impose liability on a vehicle owner, whether or not he or she is the driver. The failure to yield law, if a vehicle fails to yield to an emergency vehicle, the owner may be sent to traffic ticket to be prosecuted. The same for the school bus owner. This legislation has been patterned after the school bus owner primarily because the public safety issue is similar. When school children are exiting a bus, there's an enhanced need for public safety to protect those children. The same is can be said for the running a red light, that when people are running red lights, which is a huge public safety issue in Minneapolis, we see lots of tickets. It's just a danger to people both walking, trying to cross in the crosswalks, and people driving. The school bus are there. In this case, in the Minneapolis Stop on Red case, we never litigated any of the constitutional issues. So the district court found that the city of Minneapolis didn't have the authority to enact the ordinances and never addressed the issues. They were briefed at the trial court level by the defense and myself. The court never heard the arguments, never ruled on them. The same was said to the Court of Appeals, and the same was said at the Supreme Court this past Monday. There have been raised lots of due process concerns over this type of law, and so they haven't been litigated, but a good example of how they might be litigated in a case like that is in the school bus arm. An owner was convicted of a school bus arm violation and took that up on appeal, and the case is State v. Eakin, and it's 720 Northwest 2nd, 597. And in that case, that owner, who was not the driver and had been convicted, challenged the school bus arm on many of the issues that have been raised in our case, that it violates due process because it's imposing vicarious liability, the owner being held responsible for someone else's conduct, that it violates due process because it shifts the burden of proof from the prosecution to the defendant to prove that he or she was not the driver, that it creates a rebuttable presumption that the owner was the driver, and that violates due process. The Court of Appeals looked at all of those arguments, and the Court of Appeals ruled in favor of the state on all those arguments in the Eakin case. And so it gives us some guidance as to how they may be found in this case. In that case, they said this type of law is actually imposing direct liability on an owner. The owner is being held responsible as the owner of the instrumentality used to commit the violation, not the user, but there's two distinct classes that are being prosecuted, that this type of law does not shift the burden. The state would still have to prove that someone contested this ticket, each and every element of the offense, which is that a violation occurred, that it was caught on these images, and that the defendant on trial was in fact the registered owner of the vehicle. If in this, in the way the law is set up, there are some possible mitigating circumstances or affirmative defenses that the vehicle was stolen, that the person in fact is not the owner, the state records aren't caught up. There's been some discussion as to whether or not showing that they were not in fact the driver is a possible mitigating factor from the defense, but under the law, the fact that someone has this opportunity to present this defense doesn't shift the burden. The state has to meet its initial burden to prove a person guilty, and that's what the Eakins Court held in the school bus arm, and it addressed the whole presumption and said that because they're not criminal violations, that that doesn't apply. And so we don't know how the constitutional issues will come down. They've not been litigated in this particular fact scenario, but I think the Eakins case gives us some guidance as to how they might be viewed in a typical litigation.
Thank you.
Ben Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What happens when you put a ticket on the parked car that's illegally parked? Doesn't that have something to do with who's driving it or whatever? You're giving a ticket to the car, are you not, rather than who gets the ticket? The owner of the car, even though you may not have been driving it?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yeah, the parking tickets are written to the registered owner of the vehicle, and they receive the parking ticket and are held responsible, and they're the ones that receive the ticket and can contest it or pay it, whether or not they are affected.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Haynes, why doesn't that apply? Why can't that same principle apply here?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I'm afraid I'm not quite understanding what you're asking.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Haynes, you ticket a parked car and you ticket the owner, even though the owner may not be around. And so when you pick up a moving violation with one of your cameras, what difference does it make who's driving it? Because you're applying the same principle, I think, to a parked car as you are to a moving car.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, I agree with you on this point, and I think that part of the rationale for going after the owners of vehicles as well as the drivers is that we're trying to increase the responsibility of people when they're lending their vehicle. And no one can be absolutely 100% sure what someone's going to do when they lend their vehicle. And I think an important thing to remember is that it, as with any prosecution, there's always room for discretion. And both the police, when they're issuing the tickets, and a prosecutor, you know, when I presented with the case, I have discretion to listen to any extraordinary circumstances and things like that. And it encourages owners to one, know who's driving their vehicle. There's a lot of people out there that say, well, I don't know who had my car. There's some measure of responsibility on an owner. Who has your vehicle? And do you know, is this person someone that you know is a safe driver? Or do you know that they have a history of bad driving conduct? And there's a deterrent effect in that. And the Eakins case addresses that by taking, or by having an owner maybe say, I'm not going to lend my car to my neighbor Joe because I know he runs red lights all the time, you're removing the instrumentality, which lessens the public safety risk, because if he doesn't have a car, he can't commit the violation. And
Mr. Chairman, I think my point is, why hasn't somebody litigated the parked car ticket?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know. I've not seen anyone raise that issue, at least not in any case that I've been involved in, so I'm not sure why no one's raised it in the parking tickets.
Mr. Chair, to that point, I think you probably find a lot of fathers who would like to litigate that process. Particularly after about 3 months when they get the second notice in the mail that says you haven't paid your parking ticket, now it's doubled. But I think it goes to the issue, Mr. Chair, and Representative Earhart, that you know, a parking ticket is a lot different than running a red light. A parking ticket is maybe $5, $10, where running a red light, I would assume, is probably around $50 to $70. And I don't know. That would be a good question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Severson, in Hennepin County, and I think this is probably statewide, but at least in Hennepin County, the fine on any moving violation, including running a red light and including under the city ordinance, which is now not being enforced, the fine portion is $67. Then there's an additional $72 state surcharge, which is imposed by statute, along with a law library fee, which in Hennepin County is $3. So the entire ticket is $142 for any moving violation, running a red light, speeding, failing to yield. That's the standard fine and surcharge. It can be up to $300 because it is a petty, but that's the standard fine that's imposed in most of the cases.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, I may be one of those parents because my son just got his driver's license 2 weeks ago. So I'll look for those tickets. But to the point that Representative Earhart made, it just, I think, shows it's not unprecedented for us to hold the owner responsible. As it relates to moving violations, the fact that it's been done for the stop bus arm and the failure to yield emergency vehicles shows that previously policymakers had made the judgment that there is a certain category of offenses that are serious enough from a public safety standpoint that it's appropriate to hold the owners accountable for the behavior, even if they're not in fact driving. When the school bus stop arm law went into effect, a similar debate, even though I wasn't here for it, I'm anticipating must have taken place. And the point was that it was determined there's a serious enough public policy concern, public safety concern, that it made sense to have the law hold those owners accountable. You're not going to do that for every category of traffic offenses. As a recovering city attorney, I'm now leaving the legal arguments to our very able counsel, and I think Ms. Hayes has made the arguments why it is legal and constitutional to move forward with this bill. What's really before you is that public safety and public policy issue. And I would argue that given the threat of a red light violation, and in a red light violation, any time someone runs a red light, they are creating a very high risk of a direct conflict with another vehicle in that intersection. You can't say that about many of our other traffic violations. That's why it creates a unique public safety concern. And that's why I believe it would be good public policy for you to approve this today. There were only a couple other comments I wanted to make to anticipate some concerns that have been raised, and I would like the Assistant Chief Levinsky to add to this, but you might have heard from some, well, this is a way for cities to make money. First of all, I know there's an amendment that was raised in the Senate side. We would not object to such an amendment here that the contract in Minneapolis is such that the vendor does not get additional dollars based upon how many tickets are issued. And we certainly don't oppose that amendment. Here, the bottom line is this is to change behavior. Our goal is to achieve compliance. And long term, we believe this will make a real difference in terms of people complying with red lights. That's what we want to achieve. And then the other ones I wanted to mention, I'd like the Assistant Chief Levinsky to add to my comments. First of all, we are taking measures at intersections now to make sure they're as safe as possible, and this is not going to replace police officers. And maybe I would just ask, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, Assistant Chief Levinsky to comment on those points.
If I may, I'd just like to remind the committee, this bill, if it moves forward, goes to public safety and civil justice, and that's where all the legal questions will be answered and adopted.
Yeah. So it's going to be re-referred, actually it goes to finance, right?
Representative Tyson, does this go direct to the floor from here?
I think it probably has to go to public safety, Mr. Chair.
It was recalled. Didn't have a hearing.
What, excuse me? Oh, maybe it does. Excuse me?
It does go to public safety.
I would take it to the floor, but...
Yeah, it goes to public safety.
It was initially referred there, and then we referred it here first.
Right. And
so need to go to public safety.
Right. So I think a lot of the questions that we have, in the essence of time, and also to let them present their testimony, that we could avoid some of the legal ramifications. Assistant Chief Levinsky.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, speaking to the concern by some that stop on red actually means that officers can be reduced in a police department, exactly the opposite is happening in Minneapolis. We increased our police department actually by budgeted for 43 extra officers this year, as well as additional officers last year, and we are in the process right now of adding 11 more officers to our traffic unit, which already has 16 officers in it. So this is this measure really is something where it does not mean that we're reducing officers on the street, but really it's a unique way to add to public safety in addition to the officers who are working on other things in Minneapolis.
Thank you. And questions of Chief Levinsky?
And Mr. Chair, I think it may be useful just to, I think we're going to give one more try, because this may show, give members kind of a mental picture of what we're talking about, or more than a mental picture, it'll give them an actual picture. Okay. So these are examples of the the kind of T-bone crashes that we've been talking about. And these are actual...
These are actually from the camera?
This is from the camera. Okay.
Webcast coverage of the Minneapolis City Council is brought to you as a public service by the City of Minneapolis Office of Media Services, a division of the Communications Department.
This is the problem. Too many drivers are speeding through red lights on Minneapolis streets. You're watching the corner of 35th Street and 1st Avenue South, one of the worst corners for red light runners in town. According to one count, more than 100 drivers went through red lights here over an 8-hour period. Red light running puts many drivers at risk, and no one understands this better than Lieutenant Jeff Rugel, who's in charge of the city's traffic unit.
We get about 7,000 reported accidents every year, and about 20% of those are due to failure to yield. A large number of that is people trying to beat the yellow or just flat out running red lights.
And that, Rugel says, can cause serious crashes.
When people are trying to beat a yellow light, too often they see the light turn yellow, they hit the accelerator trying to make it, so they're probably going through the intersection a little faster than they would be ordinarily. And therefore, if they have an accident, it's likely to be a serious one.
A new program called Stop on Red targets these red light runners and uses cameras to catch them in the act. Here's how it works. Sensors are put in the ground at a problem corner. Those sensors detect a vehicle once it crosses into the intersection after a traffic light turns red. And when that happens, a battery of cameras is activated. Those cameras take pictures of the back of the vehicle and even produce a short video clip of it running the red light. This is actual video of red light runners from a similar system that's in place in Northwood, Ohio. The evidence is used to issue traffic citations. Those tickets include the images and also have an internet link drivers can visit to view the video clip on the web. The cameras only target the vehicle in violation and can only be triggered by red light runners. They are not used for surveillance. A company called Redflex provides and maintains the equipment for Stop on Red. It also provides the tickets to Minneapolis police, who make the final decision whether to issue citations. Up to 16 trouble spots across Minneapolis can be monitored by Stop on Red technology. A big factor in deciding which corners should be monitored was the number of accidents. In particular, right angle or T-bone accidents. These can only be caused by someone failing to yield the right of way.
Since most cars have airbags in the front, seatbelts are sort of designed to keep you from going forward. Getting hit from the side can be a really serious crash.
In other cities across the country, traffic light cameras have been shown to reduce the number of red light runners. It's expected that they'll have the same effect in Minneapolis, making driving safer for everyone.
President Thiessen, is there more?
I believe that's it, Mr. Chair. And we can come back for questions after the other side presents. I think there's some polls.
I think the members of the committee, you have a letter from the ACLU.
And, Mr. Chair, actually, there's an A4 amendment that members have that I would like to add on if I could as well.
An A4?
It just adds some additional protections or focus to make sure that there's an engineering study done in advance to make sure that this is the kind of accident where these red light cameras would actually have an effect. And it was actually done in Minneapolis before these cameras were installed, but it's just, I think, further protection or further makes the legislation even more focused. So if we could, if someone could move that, and if we could.
I'll move the H105884 amendment. Any questions? See, all in favor say aye, and then we can.
Aye.
Contrary. Amendments adopted. Representative Mason.
I would just like to make a question, a statement here, and maybe if there's somebody from the state patrol, they can go into the details. I remember attending a press conference held by the state patrol, maybe about 10 years ago, where they had done pilot programs at a couple of intersections in Minneapolis. Where they had a lot of people going through the red lights. They also followed up on the drivers to ask why they went through those red lights. The majority, and it was a high majority, as I remember, of people answered they were in a hurry. They saw the red light, but the response was they went through the red light anyways because they were in a hurry. And I mean, that to me was a pretty significant statement. And I've served on a city council. And there are a couple of times where I was really very, it took me a long time to approve money for a semaphore because the statistics show your fatal accidents are at intersections, not where you have stop signs.
That was, Representative Mason, that was a comment rather than a question.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, somebody can get the details of the state.
If you're all, Mr. Chair, I would just say, I, as a councilman of Minneapolis, really believe that this initiative responded directly to a lot of concerns that I heard and other people on the city council heard about traffic violations in our city and the lack of safety on our streets. There is a lot of concern, and frankly, I think there's a lot of concern right now about our driving habits because of what the representative is referring to, the lifestyle that we now see where everyone is in a hurry. I think it's too easy for people to forget the kind of threat that they're creating by their driving. And I think this, again, is about changing behavior in the end. And the existence of these lights here, of these stop on reds here, I think help also educate people throughout the city about the severity of this kind of violation.
I do have a question.
Yes.
Representative Thiessen, I think we have to clear the room sometime. We have other testifiers too.
Yes.
So, Representative Hausman had a question.
Well, Mr. Chair, you just referenced the ACLU statement, and one of the sentences said, photo enforcement of traffic violations will intrude on our fundamental right to privacy by creating a permanent photographic record of the violation. And what has always bewildered me about this is something that happens in 40 other places across this country is how people in this state, some people, are focusing on this one particular thing with such vehement opposition. When I think about cameras in convenience stores that document a crime, and we see that on television played over and over, and we see nothing wrong with it. That was a camera, it caught a crime, and we see it as a good thing. People look at that face, study it, and they determine. Cameras in police cars or state patrol cars, and we see it on television played over and over, and we see that as a good thing to catch the crime. But for whatever reason, some kind of movement in this country or whatever, this one thing that is so successful everywhere else, here in this state, we have this big issue about it. And I don't know if the city of Minneapolis has determined anything, but when I carried this bill a few years ago, never even got a hearing on it, but and so I still had in my files some of the national statistics that 800 deaths annually, 800 deaths annually, and one would think that this rises to a point that that we would want to do something about it. The one thing that I recall from that time when I studied the information was that in many of these cities, and again there are 40, and that was some time ago, it could be more, that even if people knew that in a city they were at a few corners, their behavior changed all across the city. So the whole city became safer because they installed them at a few corners, which suggests that the point you said, they are in a hurry, but boy, if they think that they might get caught, they might actually change their behavior. Anyway, it has always been a huge, huge frustration to me that something so significantly dangerous to people, we have been so hesitant when other cities across the country have not been.
Thank you, Representative. That was good testimony. We'll charge that time off to Representative.
I'll just say, Mr. Chair, that since I signed on to this bill, my behavior has certainly changed with regard to red light.
Representative, do you have other testifiers in the behalf? There's a Rich Neumeister and a Howard Bass. I don't know if they're in behalf of opponents. Representative Holberg had a question.
No, just maybe a different perspective from Representative Hausman, as somebody who doesn't support the bill. In the case of the cameras and convenience stores, we're seeing the person doing the act and the person is charged. In the case of the red light, we see a car and the owner is charged.
And Mr. Chair, I was simply responding to the ACLU testimony that they spot that this fundamental right to privacy by creating a permanent photographic record of a violation. But in fact, we do that in many places, and we use it, and we think it's a good thing.
Mr. Chair, welcome to the committee, sir. Would you? I don't know who's testifying first.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. For those folks that are new to the committee, I've been around a long time, and I do a large amount of advocacy on privacy, civil liberties, and openness in government. One of the things and the reason, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, as Representative Hausman knows, Mr. Chairman, I was one of the folks that opposed the bill when she was chief author of that bill, and it's based on a couple of reasons. One is that this is the first time that we're putting technology in law enforcement hands and are having a great impact on the state of Minnesota. This is like the first time we're doing that with law enforcement, where we're putting a law with technology, and those issues are going to bump on that. Secondly, is you might call government racketeering. Government planning in of safety, and I think there's good heart in safety. But the way they do things, it becomes government racketeering in terms of the amount of money that they collect. I'll give you some examples. In 6 years, Washington, D.C. collected $32 million. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, $5.2 million in 22 months. In the city of Minneapolis, in the 8 months that it was going at $142 a crack, 26,000 citations approximately, and I didn't have a calculator, but I figured out about 3.6 million. 2 million went to the state, 1 million goes to the local authorities in somewhat of the breakdown that was talked about. Now, doing like with anything, I did some research, because what has happened across the country once you get a couple cameras in, cities want more. Whether or not folks are going to testify this before, if I remember in the other body, Burnsville was thinking about 8, I believe. That's what I heard along County Road 242, or 42, I think they call it. Now, in the contract language between Redflex, which was heard here, and the city of Minneapolis, it says this agreement is for the implementation of up to 16 intersections, which they have, which will be determined by mutual agreement. The city has the right to expand implementation to include an additional 30 intersections. So we're talking about a possibility of 46 intersections. Now, I've shared my points in general from the philosophical bent where I'm coming on the bill. To improve the bill, I would like to suggest the following. First of all, that any citation based on a red light camera that is not in compliance with the installation, maintenance, and operational requirements specified shall be dismissed, and all monies collected shall be refunded, regardless of plea. Again, if you look at across the country in the literature, there are many situations where things go wrong. The government entity keeps the money. Things find out, you know, they're wrong, but they don't want to return the money. Rather than 21 days, as it says in the bill, it should be 10 days when the citation is mailed. Folks' memory leaves after a certain amount of time. If the ticket is returned, I would suggest personal service to go to the individual's address. You've got to remember, if a ticket is issued and the person does not pay, they get a bench warrant. based on one of these tickets. Also, I think what's very important, and which increases the amount of citations, is there's a differentiation between a minor red light offense versus a completely through the thing which you showed. And I think this is one of the things that you have to develop, is a standard statewide, rather than in the bill, you have an individual officer who might make a discretion. Should the person that's going a half a mile through a red light with no one around, you know, very slowly, a rolling California stop, should they get a ticket? Or how about the person that goes over that crosswalk, sticks into the intersection, stops real quick? Technically, that's a red light, too. And once this gets going, the cities are going to get going. The other one is number 5, a presumption of innocence for the driver, and that was a suggested thing that was in the Terwilliger bill several years ago. Reports on an annual basis to committees like yours on how much money are these cities getting and how many tickets have been issued. Another point, make the offense civil in nature. A cap of how many cameras a local authority may have based on size. A 4-year sunset. Now, there was a lot of things being used about the signs, traffic signs in Minneapolis. Well, being a Metro Mobility driver for 24 years, and I am very concerned about safety, and I've had a good, excellent safety record in that regards. Those signs are so little, it's very hard to see them. So I would like to suggest that you adopt the Arizona statute that basically brings out big signs and gives some warnings. Just like a legislator said to me, I was in Europe. And before I went to Europe, before I go with these cameras, they let me know. So I know how to change my behavior. So clear and conspicuous signage. Also, all locations will be public with an announcement with a 30-day grace period. I'm trying to do things that are just for this committee here. One of the things that was kind of interesting, an amendment you just adopted, was dealing with engineering studies. That was an item I worked on with the author in the other body. But one of the things that I came across in the contract with Redflex and Minneapolis is basically the intersections will be determined by mutual agreement between the customer and Redflex based on intersection collision history, average traffic volumes, and other pertinent safety factors. Now, I forget what it says in this amendment. It's been a week. But one of the things that I encouraged is to try some other alternatives, you know, like lengthening the yellow lights, building, you know, rebuilding. Look at those kinds of things before they install the item.
Mr. Neumeister, excuse me, do you have a lot of testimony yet? Apparently, we're supposed to be out of this. I don't want to cut you off, and I just quite don't know how to handle this bill. We may come back to more of
okay, Chairman, if I just may finish up my about three points that I think should be part of this bill. Cannot be used insurance at all. You cap the fine like most of the states do. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and finally, this is going to be a racket. To be very clear, it's for safety. And secondly, there are some privacy issues, and I think that's at least will be addressed by the other person.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. Appreciate it. I hated to cut you off, but we are kind of got all the new committee or other committee members sitting here already. So, Mr. Bass,
yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Given the time, and it's my understanding that you're reconvening at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, I am available if you would prefer. Otherwise, I think I can limit my remarks to 5 minutes.
That would be fine, because tomorrow morning we also are going to be, we have to adjourn. It's 9:30, and I'm afraid the agenda we have, we're going to be pressed for now.
All right.
We could just take 5 minutes more from
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Howard Bass. I'm a ACLU of Minnesota Board of Directors member and also the volunteer attorney in State versus Crewman. I represent the defendant in the Minneapolis Photocop case. Over the past year and a half, I have developed a great deal of knowledge and expertise in the area of photographic traffic law enforcement. Based upon the time, based upon the questions that I've heard, as well as the comments from the chair, I'm going to limit my remarks. I'm not going to talk about the legalities of such a program. I'm not even going to address due process, although I think you've had hasn't been a sufficient discussion, but we'll save that for the Public Safety Committee. I want to focus my remarks on public policy, specifically privacy, which I believe will be the defining civil liberties issue of the 21st century. As technology continues to advance, so too will government's potential to engage in surveillance on its citizens. Representative Houseman, you alluded to cameras in convenience stores. The Constitution only prohibits government conduct, not individual conduct, not businesses' conduct. It's completely separate. What we're concerned about today is the extent to which government has the ability to violate privacy rights of its citizens. According to the United States Supreme Court, the Constitution protects legitimate expectations of privacy which society is prepared to accept. As duly elected representatives, you play a dominant role in determining what expectations of privacy our society considers reasonable. This is where the rubber meets the road in terms of constitutional privacy protections. I want to paraphrase a great American hero, Neil Armstrong, and suggest to you that passage of this bill would be one small step for traffic enforcement, but one giant leap towards a 1984 Orwellian society where Big Brother monitors our every movement. I urge you not to go down the slippery slope of surveillance creep. Once this genie is out of the bottle, I assure you, you will not be able to put it back in. I want to take just a minute to demonstrate how inevitable the expansion of photographic law enforcement will be. If you look at the picture nationally, just on traffic law enforcement, 10 years ago, there were two cities in this entire country that used red light cameras, San Francisco and New York. As we sit here today, there are more than 250 communities across 22 states and the District of Columbia that use red light cameras. There will be a natural progression from red light violations to speeding violations, as is done in numerous communities across the United States. Ultimately, in Minnesota, it's going to go to metered ramp violations, probably HOV violations. And ultimately, this paves the road to use photographic enforcement on other criminal, not just traffic violations. If you listen to the debate that occurred on Friday morning in front of the Senate Transportation Committee, Senator Bonoff reluctantly voted for the companion bill. And her statement was she wished the cameras could be used instead of to enforce traffic violations, to enforce homicides, to put cameras up in high crime areas where we could use them to reduce our homicide rates. That would be the next logical step. And after that, other communities are going to say, well, if these communities have cameras to protect their safety, we want them in our communities. And ultimately, inevitably, inexorably, you will have cameras on each and every corner of the state. All you have to do is look at the DNA collection laws in this state. 15 years ago, there were none. 15 years ago, the legislature enacted a law whereby convicted sex offenders would have to surrender a specimen of their DNA for inclusion in a BCA database for sex offenders. Then, several years later, a one-year experiment where anyone convicted of a felony during that 1 year would have to give a DNA sample. Then 3 years. Then whenever. And last year, I think it was, the legislature passed a law, which has since been held unconstitutional, that upon a finding of probable cause that you've committed any felony without a conviction, you've got to give a sample of your DNA. In jurisdictions across the country, there are laws where people arrested for any offense, even misdemeanors, have to surrender DNA specimens. Look at what happened last week. The Inspector General's report from the FBI on the Patriot Act violations. thousands and thousands of bank records, of cell phone records, of internet records, disclosed in violation of the Patriot Act by the obtained by the FBI under national security letters that were never judicially authorized. You have to be careful about how much power you give to a governmental entity to engage in this type of surveillance. I want to conclude by quoting another American hero, Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin, one of the founders of our nation, once said, "Those who would sacrifice liberty for security deserve neither." To paraphrase Mr. Franklin, I submit those who would sacrifice privacy for safety deserve neither. We've heard a lot about safety. I am here to tell you that you can be safe and free without surrendering any of your privacy. This is a report that was issued by Congress in 2001 by the Office of the Majority Leader, Republican Dick Armey, U.S. House of Representatives. It's entitled, "The Red Light Running Crisis, Is It Intentional?" The findings contained in this report demonstrate, as a result of traffic engineering studies, that the best way to decrease the number of red light violations and to make intersections safe is to lengthen the period of time that lights are yellow and to incorporate an all-red interval. In the executive summary, just a few sentences that encapsulate these full 21 pages, the report reads, in short, the only documented benefit to red light cameras is to the pocketbook of local governments who use the devices to collect millions in revenue. We traded away our privacy for this. We gave up our constitutional protections for this. In return, we are less safe. That is the red light camera scam. It has gone on for too long. It concludes with these three short sentences. We should never have allowed the personal privacy of our citizens to be undermined by these big brother devices. In the name of safety, we sacrificed our privacy, but now it is clear that we have been asked to relinquish our cherished freedoms for an entirely empty promise. I urge you not to sacrifice your constituents' constitutional right of privacy for an empty promise of safety, which could better be achieved through alternative traffic engineering methods as reflected in the Congressional report, which do not threaten our cherished freedoms and our American way of life. Do not take that giant leap towards 1984. George Orwell's visionary book, written in 1949, depicting a country completely under surveillance where Big Brother knows what we're doing at every moment. This is the first step. Do not take that step towards 1984. I urge you to vote against House File 1058. I realize I've gone a little over. I'd be happy to take questions. If anyone wants a copy of this report, it's footnoted on the second side of the ACLU fact
sheet. Are there any questions from the members? And thank you, Mr. Bass. Are there questions from the members? Sorry, I'm going to cut you up. We've got to get out. Representative Thiessen, I don't know what you consider. I don't know if the committee is ready for a vote or if we should lay this over temporarily.
Ready?
Is there enough? I don't think we have any time for any further testimony.
I have none further. Yes.
No.
Is there any questions from the committee? If not, are you ready for the vote?
Yes.
You want to renew your motion, Representative Thiessen?
I can't.
Oh, see, I would
renew the motion.
I
don't think Bernie made it.
Renew the beg your pardon?
You made it?
Right. Mm-hmm. I renew the motion to that House File 1058, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Public Safety and Civil Justice Committee. All in favor say aye.
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 Contrary?
No.
The motion prevails. House 1058 is sent to the Public Safety and Civil Justice. We're adjourned until 8 o'clock tomorrow morning.